Yes, you are. Good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock, and thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and this is Finding a Voice, spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, in both hours actually today, from this year's Poets at Art Fest, Poetry Festival, you'll hear the very first of the readings from it this series will pretty much dominate the next several weeks of this show. There will be other things from time to time, but pretty much this is going to be it. In the first hour, you'll hear readings by Leslie Saunders, Sarah B. Wiseman, Dorothy Stoholm, Ann Archer, and Anna Johnson. And in the second hour, again, from that same day, the June 28th, Poets at Art Fest Poetry Festival. You'll hear readings by Catherine Jones, Anne Graham, Kin Man Young Tai, and Erica Lamone. Just a top of the hour thing I try to do each hour is just let you know that occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on the show may contain strong language, but I try to preserve that as much as I can to honor the integrity of the work and the poet, writer, or composer themselves. This is one of those I usually try when I do this event every year or air this event every year is to try to do it pretty strictly chronologically, but I have to jump around a little bit. This is a case in point. You will actually hear the first reading of the morning in the second hour today, but right now you're going to hear what was the early afternoon session, at least part of it. And so up first, here are Leslie Saunders, Sarah Wiseman, Dorothy Stoholm, Ann Archer, and Anna Johnson does appear in this hour as well, but she was in that second group. Well, let's go ahead and just jump right in, and here we go. I hope you enjoy. Leslie Saunders is always pleased to come out of the shadows at Art Fest and make her once-a-year appearance as a poet. The rest of the year is mostly spent trying to convince her dog that a very few of our neighbors are interested to hear the news. Bunny, 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 we saw Bunny, especially at 6 o'clock in the morning. Leslie is working on a poetic memoir because why not? Today she will be reading several vignettes from this collection in progress. Let's bring up Leslie Saunders. Let me move the recorder then closer. How's that?
Let's just make it really complicated.
Well, it's just that it won't pick you up very well back there. So
I'm not sure that's a problem. I'm going to be reading this memoir I've been working on, and it occurred to me a bit too late that my life isn't that interesting, and I really don't know why any of you would be interested in it, but here we are. It's all I brought. So I invite you to transfer my words into your own experiences and whatever, and maybe just enjoy some memories. First one, I'm sure every family has one of these. It's called The Skeptic. When my mother asked my niece, who had recently started daycare, if she liked her teachers, and my niece replied, "We don't have any teachers, just a dog named Marlene. That's who takes care of us." My mother thought my niece was lying. "Oh, Carol," she challenged. And I think this says a lot about our family. Who would name a dog Marlene? And my mother's worldview, fine to leave your preschooler with a herding beast with no prehensile thumbs, but do not abuse the dignity of an animal with a people name. I suspect some of us have had misadventures with our siblings. And this is a summer poem. The Pact. Having successfully snuck the kitten past our mother, my sister and I clear out our middle dresser drawer. Being responsible owners, we place a bowl filled with fresh water. Add a saucer full of milk and salmon sandwiches we pilfered at lunchtime. I put my new and favorite sweater, brought to me by my aunt all the way from Shetland, to make a warm and woolly bed. And when we go down swimming, our absence would be suspicious, we make sure she gets fresh air, leave the drawer open just a crack. But we do not stay swimming long, claim absorption in a board game, and race back. Our mother's life of laundry, kitchen things, games of solitaire, cursing the kids' constant clamor and clutter, and drinking her endless cups of tea, keeps her quite busy. She doesn't seem to notice we spend hours together in our room, inexplicably not squabbling. Though she does hear our constant to and fro out back, her only comment is a mechanical, well-worn, "I'm telling you for the last time, stop slamming that screen door." The kitten is quiet, clean, contented. All is going well. For 2 days. Day 3. Our brother finds us. But he is a quiet boy of few words, so we make a pact. Cross our hearts and hope to die if anyone teaches him the word kitty or pussycat. Freshly toileted, played with, petted, milk and water, air crack safe and secure, we go for a swim and then come back. It is never a good thing when our mother stands at the door waiting, or when her foot taps, or when she points her finger to our brother who sits with our secret kitten in his lap. When the long and scalding lecture, when the list of crimes, lying, hiding, sneaking, stealing, concealing, ruining good clothes all the way from Shetland, procuring pets without permission, going behind her back, when the boil and royal runs down into a simmer, we lift our bowed and shamefaced heads and dare to ask, "But how did you find out?" Childhood milestones did us in. Lacking the word for cat, our baby brother crooked his tiny finger and set the kitten free with his first complete, though simple, sentence. "Come and see." One of the things that I was exploring was those moments in our lives when we have our first epiphany or our first experience of something. And this was a big one for me. Geological events. I'm a gap-toothed second grader, and my cat, more than a week, missing. Already my mother has covered with deep black nothing the place the saucer of milk has always sat. When in from the back, my older brother, who just yesterday was so ordinary, but today, as he speaks, earth clangs her supersonic cymbals, tectonic plates collide and crack, though he says simply, "Look who I found. I am as astonishing as lightning, charged and charging, snatch and crusher to my chest, while some volcanic rupture of things I have no words for spews its lavic rivers down my cheeks." That was the day I learned crying for happy was a thing. So in many ways, they're familial things, traits. We tend to look like our parents and our siblings. Often our quality of voice is similar to our parents and siblings. And this is about another similarity. Black snow. Here you are, falling, letter-shaped flakes spreading the bleached blank scape of my page, falling from my pen. I am put in mind of the gray ash on my mother's white cigarette, her pink finger poised. So she, too, is here. But I am surprised it is you that I tap from this tip. I always knew I held my father in my script, my T's and threes and exactness of the crumbling catalog of box supplies above his workbench. But how is it I never noticed until now you emerging, pentimento, from where you must have always been? How you must have somehow absorbed me in your pudgy hand when you bent your head, pressed tongue to top lip, and squeezed a spudge of emerging penmanship into a scribbler. I'd know your handwriting anywhere. The glimpsed initials claiming a now closed book, a list on a scrap of wine foolscap found tucked in a drawer crack, stops my breath. And suddenly, so clearly, here, in the slant and angle and height, the tense of my F's, the flare of my M's. And I am hungry to do this. I could write all day to be this conjurer, just to have this magician's simple sleight of hand calling you home. Close with another summerish poem. A woman who should be writing sits at her desk and is thinking about licorice, not the salty coils from the old Dutch shop, nor the pipe-shaped ones from our Christmas stockings, tips aglow with red sugar beading, but the kind with silver keys and aortic thrums. How lucky to be born a girl whose dad played Dixie on a summer's day, burnt grass under clarinet. That kind of licorice, long black voodoo stick, more dangerous in certain hands than any pistol. A man can wield that thing with a leant-on swing, and it will lure your life juice. In winter, Dad would flip a stack of 78s on the turntable. Some guy named B. Goodman pulls you from your game of dolls. What I'm saying is, you are young when that deep ebony opens throat, everts itself, insides sliding out, notes rounder than doom, sooty, the taste having already slipped past your lips, desire. Disaster. Candy.
Coming up next, I'm going to do something here too. There we go. Nobody likes to sit in the front row. There you go. You want to just take it into the back? Thanks. Thank you all. Coming up next, Sarah B. Wiseman has many creative passions, but her first love is poetry. Her poetry has appeared in various literary journals over the last 25 years and in a chapbook entitled Portraits. In 2023, Sarah initiated the Wild Art Walk, now a yearly exhibit of local art installations displayed along the Forest Trail in Battersea, just north of Kingston. The past year, she has built and has been updating the poetry bench. Bench on the same trail where you can read and listen to a different poem by a different poet each month. Let's bring up Sarah.
Hi. I can't see you when I look up, so we'll see what happens. I'm also going to read some poems about my mother. She passed away in the winter, and I've written a lot of poems about her over the last 5 years. She had Alzheimer's before she died, and there was a lot of stuff that came from that. But I thought I would read some poems from when she was younger, some stories that she told me from her nursing school days. And then I'll read one more recent one and a couple poems about grief and end on a lighter note, I think. But so just warning that sad poems ahead. Sheree went to nursing school in St. John's, Newfoundland. Nursing school, 1952. One. I keep thinking this is a mic. It's not. Nursing school, 1952. One. The hospital is brand new. She stares down the long khaki hallways, sprawling in all directions, like paths her mind takes, wandering off through the maze, long before her feet have started walking, haunted by lessons that have no teacher, no face to ask questions of, no body to blame. The nurses are ancient, shuffling around with needles and charts, smoking in the corners, practically vampires, satisfied by any extended wrist popping with veins. They show her how to approach the sick, check vitals, expose the thin, tender skin, prick precisely. Two. In the outer wards are shared dorms and a cafeteria turned dance hall, a place they can study the bodies of boys up from the army base on Friday nights, well-dressed with egos and hard-ons. She masters moving in and out of arms and elbows, hooks and spins, holding new knowledge of anatomy and bone. Their hearts beat quick against hers and then away. With a flex of muscle, her hand on the back of their necks, she can bring them close or let them go. Grasp their silences, whether they're gentle or cold, willing or afraid. Through the lens of her own gaze, she gleans how best to avoid the ones who push too much, look too long, learn to lean into their eagerness just enough, and to decipher the impulses of her own desire when the pores of her skin open instinctively, when intimacy emerges, an urgency on the dance floor. She memorizes the pulse of each partner by heart. Three. She learns how to prepare a body, how to disrobe and disinfect. They practice in pairs, lifting and balancing the weight. An old man, fingernails swabbed, epidermis washed away. The TB smell seeps through her mask, cuts into her like sea wind, taking her back to ocean cliffs, her father barely there, even in plain sight. The stench of his illness wrapping around her as she collects urchins. Evenings, fitting together broken shells, she listens to his gravel voice spin yarns, breathless between sentences. Four. After midterm, there is a baby in the morgue. Blooms of coagulated blood, the leafy thin skin sliced cleanly, peeled back. She stands to examine the dead. Her world, too, opened up. Inside, slim flooded arteries wrapped delicately around the heart. Her own beats in her throat. To learn from this death, salvage its teachings. She touches the small body, still so close to its source, so freshly alive. This one is a more recent poem. And it's called My Mother is Home. And I've actually had a lot of incarnations of this poem, but it reads both in columns and also across. So I'm going to read it both directions. And the second time may be a bit repetitive and it may be less, maybe make less sense, which was representative of my mom's experience with Alzheimer's. My mother is lace, flecked blank spots, intricate knots woven in and around what she knows, what she used to know. She speaks open and ancient, a different way of knowing. My mother is a seashell, filled and emptied by generations of waves, an ocean of stories alive in her. I want to put her to my heart and listen. She was born steps from the sea, would fall asleep with the sound of the surf coming so close, and then the ebb, a receding tide. She is pulling away new stones each day. She tells me she is on her way to a place called home. My mother is water, a wild crest, murky depths. I fear I will fall in. But sometimes, moments, she is so clear, could drink a full glass. I hold her hand like I am forever thirsty. My mother is lace, flecked with the sound of the surf. Blank spots, intricate knots woven, coming so close, and then the ebb, in and around what she knows, a receding tide. She is pulling away what she used to know. She speaks new stones each day. She tells me, open and ancient, a different way. She is on her way to a place of knowing. My mother is a seashell called home. My mother is filled and emptied by generations of water, a wild crest, murky depths, waves, an ocean of stories I fear I will fall in. But sometimes, alive in her. I want to put her to moments she is so clear, could drink my heart and listen. She was born a full glass. I hold her hand like I am steps from the sea, would fall asleep, forever thirsty. I'm not going to read that one, but this one's called Later Grief. The cat rubs against you. You let it. The Almanac of Sorrow. Turn the page, the fine print, while tossing and turning. Without question, morning glories. Your knees touch the ground. Withdrawal while pouring milk. And again, when night falls like ice. Take leave of yourself. Do not change course. Find a rock. Solidify. While paying taxes on the kitchen floor. Get a new phone, a fidget spinner, a friend. Charades. Rage. Birch bark, so spare. The book of loneliness, hook, line, and sinker. Cigarettes. Road trip, crash course, crack a window, inhale, swelter. Later, exhale. Eyes in the rear view, horizon. And this one is, it was originally started as part of a poem called Touching Happiness. And it's a little lighter, and it's about a bird, which my mom loved birds, so it does feel still fitting to read this. First, the bird was inside me. First, the bird was inside me, and it felt like a dance, an athletic jive, or maybe swing. I knew every elbow hook and hip sway, as though it had been with me for years, but ignored. Muffled tweets here and there, a repressed tickle, and now the rising flicker. Let's do it again, I shouted. Again. I couldn't stop moving, thrown and caught by some unseen partner. A small bird kicking around in me, ping-ponging between useless and essential organs. My brain was a fluttering jester, my heart a cuckoo's fool. Then I shivered and choked on a feather. another feather, and finally, a whole wing emerged from my mouth. It wanted out. The breast came too with little trouble, hardly the exertion one might have expected. I rocked back and forth. It took merely a minute, or possibly an hour. A certain kind of ecstasy happens when you have a bird inside you. Time travel is possible, divination, teleportation, all sorts of indiscretion. I was stretching in odd directions, all a dither, my toes spread wide, lifting from the ground as the bird passed my lips. Its beak scratched a little, but no more than a lover's peck. The second wing gave me goosebumps, and all at once crow's feet settled onto my tongue. My body felt a sudden grace, and it flew.
Coming up next, Dorothy Soholm is the author of a collection of poems called Holding the Mirror, a poetry chapbook called Wait for the Final Explosion, and a novella in verse, Why the Telephone Stopped Ringing. Her work has appeared in literary journals in Canada, USA, and England, in numerous anthologies. In 2015, she completed an MFA in creative writing through UBC, where she studied under Susan Musgrave and Gary Geddes. Dorothy loves Eastern Ontario, and for the last 20 years, she and her husband have spent summers at their cottage on Kennebec Lake, about an hour north of here. Let's bring up Dorothy.
Looking at you from this perspective, I didn't know there were so many people here. Now I'm really nervous. Thanks, Bruce. I love being here. We always love the Kingston Art Fest. It's great. I'd like to start by reading a couple of poems from my last book, Why the Telephone Stopped Ringing. In the book, the narrator, it tells a story of twin sisters who grow up on a farm in Ontario. And it ranges in time from the 1950s to the early 2000s, various cities throughout Canada, and a kind different kinds of verse forms. The narrator, Deirdre, has just found out that she has a brain tumor and is facing death, and she's going back over her life and all the guilt she feels about her twin sister and how her twin sister's life went, and she feels responsible. So the first thing I'm going to read is a prose poem called Beginning. Slow down, start at the beginning, Mother would say, when I'd rush in to tell her about Cassie's current adventure. Cass had a pitchfork stuck in her leg, a wire in her eye. She'd been cornered by the bull in the pasture we weren't supposed to enter, wedged under a giant easel she'd built. Where could I start? There was never any beginning with Cass. Just her usual ending. Ha! Huh, that was a good one, eh? And later in school, teachers tried to impose a fictional order on facts. Start at the beginning, they'd say. Your readers should know right away where you are, who you are, who's with you. Where are you right now? Cass used to say when she phoned, wanting every detail. I was on the farm north of Toronto, or in my city apartment, a maiden trapped in a towering cliche. I was teaching in Everdale School. I knew my coordinates, but I didn't know where I was, where Cassie was, what story she was creating, what version of herself. Was she with or against me? Everything is in flux. The chair, the desk, atoms colliding in time and space in a way I don't understand. These papers I sort through now. Poems by somebody with my name. a girl who no longer exists, who smiles in fading family photos I am about to toss. I study myself, an old woman on a carpet once valued for its bright colors and fluid design. A stain in the pattern becomes a butterfly perched on a milkweed, swaying or pinned to a card for a science fair project. Where is the butterfly now? The old woman asks. Was I there when they pinned her down? Did I do the pinning? She recalls a frozen pond and a lie told in childhood. The lie may have ruined her twin sister's life. A streak of sunlight crosses the carpet, slices through shadow, and splits it open. The split reveals nothing. Your readers must understand what's going on, the instructor said. But why? The old woman asks. It's an imitation of life. A pile of unsorted laundry and lint, stained underwear, one missing sock, fuzzify your expectations. A voice calls. Deirdre! It's her husband, Eric, but she won't stop sorting. Frantic, relentless, a game show contestant trying to beat the clock, a movie heroine struggling to defuse the bomb as the seconds flash by in red. She's Alice's white rabbit. Her twin sister, Cassie, is already dead when the story begins. It begins at the end. The stage is set. And this next one is a free verse poem called Toronto 2003. They take me to see your body, swollen in places, but mostly bone thin. Bruises and scars like purple statements written on snow. A postmodern look. You and not you. The gun unexpected. Somebody tells me they found a pit bull beside you, wouldn't let anyone near. Somebody phoned the pound, had the dog put down. I wasn't able to rescue him either. And I'll just do one more. This one's called Toronto 2011. I pack my life into boxes, ready for what lies ahead. The telephone shrills, an old colleague, uneasy. A conversation on stilts. Trying not to fall off, I make an 11th hour attempt to recollect nebulous names, circumstances of mutual friends. I joke about seniors and absent-mindedness, but yearn to forsake the charade, lose the need to keep up appearances. Longing to join you wherever you are. Okay, and my latest manuscript is more of an elbows up kind of thing. It's based entirely on Canadian poets. It's just glosses. I don't know if you're familiar with the form, but you steal four lines from one poet and then you build your whole poem on those four lines. So all the lines I stole were all Canadian. And the first one is called Loyalist Descendant, and the lines that I stole are from Margaret Atwood. Who else? The Blazed Trail, she wrote. I pick my way slowly with you through the blazed forest, scar by scar, back through history, following the rule. Loyalist Descendant, Part 2. You say there's one rule for discerning how we came to be in this place, how the trail through the forest was cut, and why we should go ahead boldly, remain always proud of our history, our land. But sometimes I find myself feeling lost and unholy. I pick my way slowly, unconvinced. I wonder why others were left behind, and so many animals lost. You say, I just chorus the comments of woke, radicals, whiners, tree huggers, and so I move on, as I feel I must, with you through the blazed forest. But I carry my ancestors' guilt with me always. Though I can imagine their terror as well on that long northward trek, the hostile woods and citizens, broken down transport, and children crying and wondering who they could trust, and the dark, dark nights and the scrubland gift from the Brits, though not theirs to give. I can picture that too, scar by scar, back through the decades of loss, amid empires and conquests. How sometimes they must have questioned themselves and their loyalties, yet remained firm for king and country, and schooled their children and children's children to honor, conserve tradition, religion, to cling to the unraveling thread on the spool, history following the rule. And this last piece is the title piece of my new manuscript called Complicit, based on these lines from Priscilla Uppel. I have lost my travels currently. Each song changes with the times. See me floating across the damp banks of your river. See me drift out of the corner of your eye. Mornings, I rise reluctant, not knowing where I am or why the strangeness of life assails me from inside the mirror and scuttles synapses inside my head. The itch of wool blankets, once fervently counseling me to arise, now offer a welcome retreat. I call out for guidance, ask for the key. I have lost track of my travels currently, seeking a sign, a portent of miracles in the offing, relief from the nightly news, a Twitter account's mad offering and Facebook's response. I vaguely recall sunny climes, the aroma of pineapple sliced on a sun-drenched beach, drifting through cheerful lyrics of coconuts and limes. But each song changes with the times. The new hymns threaten disaster and violent misogyny under the guise of God's love. They claim to offer salvation for those who can sing in the pre-approved key, but never question the arrest of undocumented parents at hospital, their son in surgery. Apathy is now clever. See me float on the damp banks of your river, pretending the climate has not changed. The name of the game is denial. Denial and greed. Lock her up, screamed the crowd at the convention, sporting the tight-fitting shirts you could buy, emblazoned with her severed head. Fearful, I keep my head down, not wanting to die. See me drift out of the corner of your eye. Thank you.
Another hand.
Just thought I'd mention too, she does have a few copies of Why the Telephone Stopped Ringing back on the table back there if you're interested. Coming up next, this is Ann Archer's bio.
It's a true or false. One, Ann Archer lives in a cabin in the woods near Charbot Lake where she writes poetry and plays the flute. Two, she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for her role as the wife in Fatal Attraction. Three, she plays Molly's lawyer in Adrienne Murray's 2022 film Retrograde. Or four, she often writes under a nom de plume, Archer Lundy. Or five, she is a reluctant gardener. Let's bring up Ann Archer.
This group, I feel honored to be part of this. And Sarah,
it's me.
Nice to meet you too. Sarah's project, the wild, the poetry bench in the Wild Art Walk, is it's near and dear to my heart because I was the April poet. So, the last poet in our series, I guess I'm the fifth poet. I'm keeping it short. I'm going to start with the news. Can resist a penny whistle. Note, I stood back when I was playing the whistle, but I'll move up now that I'm reading. So, stories. We hitch ourselves to stories. At least, that's what I thought last night. I mean, this morning at 2. The moon a lump over the water meadow, waning and blousy, light years away from bed. The moon who comes and goes as she pleases, a mistress on the dark side of her prime, still working the system. This morning, I got up, went outside, walked around the house just to catch a glimpse. I was naked and cold. I could tell by the ambient light she was somewhere, but the sky was empty. Through the window, I could hear my husband snore, flat on his back, with our cat and the moon in his arms. Thank you. This is a sequence that I wrote about my maternal grandfather, George Clark Archer. It's called Geordi. He caught the eye of the street photographer, or did the photographer catch his eye? Such a handsome man, my grandfather. Three-piece suit and fedora, hand in hand with me, a five-year-old urchin with a jacket half a size too small, hat sliding off a pixie cut, knee socks pooling at the ankles, mismatched. I mean, my grandfather and I. He had no friends that I can recall, though his brother Willie had tea with us one afternoon. Gramps welcomed him as you would a man with a tin cup in their apartment on Broadway once Nana was out. Nana died, I came home to a house in mourning, drapes drawn, my grandfather sitting on our guest bed. Surprised by death, Gramps and I, beyond comfort or succor, so completely alone. My mother thought we had each other. But my grandfather wasn't there anymore, absent and without. After my grandmother died, I ignored him. A side effect of grief or nascent puberty. He moved in with us, stayed mostly in his downstairs bedroom, carved out of a rec room. Had his own bathroom and the occasional accident. Wouldn't eat tomatoes, but loved ketchup. And green relish, homemade, slopped over pork tenderloin. Desserts, puddings from packages, pies, cake. He ate, then retired to his room like a boarder. Had his first flight at 90, catapulted across two provinces. My grandfather trusting in nothing he couldn't name or no longer believed in. The upstairs spare room in our new home was a way station before his final destination. The Veterans Hospital, the other side of hell. For the 2 weeks he was with us, he cried out in his sleep for mother, wet his bed. When I got back from school, one afternoon, he was gone. This is a coda. Thank you. A coda for that poem. Memory peeled back to pith and bone. When I was old enough to sit still, but too young to talk, my grandfather and I would perch by the corner window in his kitchen in the Princeton Apartments on Broadway and watch pigeons. I can't say which one of us was more peristeronic as we tried to mimic their throat song, their gargle and giggle. I learned pigeon before I could speak. And sorceled by sound, by syllables that coo and flutter, flutter and coo. Thank you.
Well, thank all of you for coming out to this second session, full session, in the first day of four-day poetry festival. If you want to know the full schedule, it's back there on that little bulletin board. There are also bios there if you're interested in that. I can tell you, coming up in the next session at 3 o'clock, you will hear Ron Chase, Alana Veach, Meg Freer, Calista Markotic and Jane McDonald. So I hope to see you then, and enjoy the rest of Art Fest, or talk to the poets who just read. So thank you.
And you just heard from this year's Poets at Art Fest 4-Day Poetry Festival readings by Leslie Saunders, Sarah B. Wiseman, Dorothy Soholm, and Ann Archer. It is about 49 minutes after 4 o'clock. You are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And just a quick reminder that I upload both hours of this show each week. week to my personal blog space for it when I get home at Finding a Voice on CFRCFM.wordpress.com. Will be at some point, hopefully this evening, and they will remain there for 3 years. My heartfelt thanks to all of you for having tuned in to this first segment in this first hour, and an equal heartfelt thanks to all the poets who participated this year and all of the others. It was amazing who came out to listen and support those poets. So I'm going to just continue uninterrupted because this is a very tight show today, and I want to make sure and get everything in. So like I said at the start, usually I go chronologically, but what we did, it fit better to air the second session first. So what I'm going to do now is begin the first session. So these were the very first readings that day. And in it, you're going to hear readings by Anna Johnson, who will still be in this hour. But then immediately, there's no break. You're going to hear readings then in that first session by Catherine Jones and Graham Kinman Young Chai and Erica Lamone. And let's see where I'm sitting. I'll just I'll catch you at the end of the second hour. So I hope you enjoy this. Again, heartfelt thanks to everyone, both of all of you out there and all of those at the festival. Here we go again.
Anna Johnson is a professor in public health sciences who always has enjoyed writing through her academic career. More importantly, has expanding her writing into the creative realm. She received mentorship through the City of Kingston Poet Laureate program under Sadiqa Demeyer and read her poems from it at a KFPL event in April. She has had two of her poems published in the last year in Devour and Devour Art and Lit magazine. And her poems are published monthly in the Kingston's Neighbors East and Southwest magazine. She facilitates writing workshops. For more information, visit her at her website, www.anna, that's with one N, annajohnsonauthor.com. Let's bring up Anna.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Bruce. What a lovely sunny day. It's really turning. Well, today I'd like to read a poem that was originally inspired by a call from Sadiqa Demeyer, City of Kingston Poet Laureate, about the La Salle Causeway. For those of you who don't know, this is a bridge that allows pedestrians and vehicles to pass between the east side of Kingston and downtown. And it's a bridge that existed, that has existed there for centuries. Originally, there was a bridge made out of wood. Used to be called the Penny Bridge, as pedestrians dropped a penny to cross it. It was then replaced by a bascule bridge, meaning it goes up and down, made out of green metal to allow maritime movement. Around COVID, it was replaced by a metal bridge, which is the one we currently have that closes every Sunday. If you live on the east side, you would know, to allow crafts through. And so for that call, we were asked to send a verse or two, and Sadiqa would collate the pieces into a group poem. It could be about the bridge making me late for work, for example. It could be anything. So that's to come. Looking forward to that. So I sent, I was really inspired by this, and I sent an entire poem to Devour Lit, Art and Lit Canada, an esteemed literary magazine, and I was just delighted to that it was accepted for a publication. It will appear in this summer's issue. And of course, yours truly, Bruce Kaufman, is the poetry editor for that great magazine. Without further ado, here is the poem. La Salle Causeway. Launching from the Kingston Yacht Club, kayaking along Lake Ontario into the throat of the Cataraqui River, among the elements, One paddle splash after another, bass breath shimmering, on my torso twisting, muscle spasms, one more, then another, right, left, right, some days at the wind's wrists, surfing the waves, other days flat, flickering on quiet, lucid emerald and blue. Diamond speckles, mirrored clouds, and under the verdant bascule bridge, hums and sways of shadowy vehicles, echoing on the naked water. A faraway splash moves in my ear. I am swallowed into a drafting call, into the void, into the beginning and the end of time. Thank you. Thanks. So that will be in the issue. So exciting. All right. So along the lines of a group poems, I'd like to bring your attention to, as Bruce did, a workshop that I started just 3 weeks ago following a couple of books, facilitating this right now on Thursdays at 6:30 to 8. And we meet at coffee shops. Bruce told you the website, annajohnsonauthor.com with one N, Anna with one N. But anyway, in reflection of this, for our first meeting, we wrote a group poem in that writing workshop, and I'd like to read that next. I've called it Awaken, and you'll see why after it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 35. Should I always count? Can I jump? Jump, jump into the sky, or fly, fly above the floating clouds. Slip the surly bonds of earth. Dive, drink the depths of sensations. Explore the unknowns. Don't be afraid of being burnt, hurt, being there. How can I be there, for I'll hurt? Hurt so much the throat hurts. I cough off a pine cone, laugh. The waves and wall break. So this type of group poem has been called the exquisite corpse. Exquisite corpse. I don't know if you've heard of it. Whereby each member of our writing workshop wrote two lines at a time separately. Then the next person did the same, only going by the last line written of the previous person, ending up with a cohesive poem. Wow. And these exercises were largely conducted primarily in the 1920s by French surrealist writers, and they were influenced by Carl Jung, the psychologist, and the idea is to access the unconscious. Through this order and order, as we see in this exercise, we're able to meet a threshold of and unlock our emotions and creativity. And then that gets funneled into the conscious mind. So, and it was called Exquisite Corpse because the first line of a exercise like this in the 1920s, it was the exquisite corpse drank the young wine. So the name remained. The last poem I'll read is one that also came out of our last workshop this last Thursday. And the prompt was to work through a concept and then a resolution of some sort. So here it is. I termed it War and Peace. Biannual Abrams tank snakes in refurbished Ohio factory floors, or monthly homemade drones in Ukraine's garages spaced across a 100-mile radius that shall sink so bright, warding off cowering Black Sea Russian naval ships. Why fight and wars? Chaos and disagreement. White blood cells fight within bodies to maintain health. Wisdom warns, the most efficient production shall win. Has Mars weapon brought peace? At the cost of rivers of blood for soil, at the price of the cancerous cells of your memory? Is a country worthy of praise for its domestic peace, authoritarianism, and oppression? in the face of posterity, of peace? Do you wear each cell and molecule in exactly the way it's meant, in every moment, hour, second? And so, even when death